Hello and welcome. You're listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. Hello and welcome to episode 114 of Writers Aloud. In this episode, RLF writers Robin Bolam, Alex Martin, Lynn Webster Wild and Peter Forbes share their enthusiasm for their favourite author. The novelist William Faulkner had some simple advice for would-be writers. Read everything, he said. Trash, classics, good and bad, and see how they do it. Just like a carpenter who works as an apprentice and studies the master. Read, you'll absorb it. Then write. If it is good, you'll find out. Poet Tess Gallagher had similar observations with an emphasis on finding the authors you love. When you start reading in a certain way, she said, that's already the beginning of your writing. You're learning what you admire, and you're learning to love other writers. The love of other writers is an important first step, to be a voracious, loving reader. Here at Writers Aloud, we talk with many RLF authors about their writing lives, but we also like to hear about their lives as readers. Who inspired them to start writing? Who do they respect and why? Who do they go back to time after time? In this second instalment of our series, we've once again asked four RLF writers that tricky and delicious question, who is your favourite author? First up is poet and editor Robin Bolam, who has a fascination with 16th and 17th century drama, which, coincidentally enough, is where we find her favourite author.
My favourite author is Shakespeare, because I grew up with Shakespeare. Strangely, his were the first stories I heard, and then he gave me a career, which is something I've always been grateful for. I don't know quite how it happened. I became an academic accidentally, but the topic for my PhD was Shakespeare and Jacobean dramatists. So he moved through my life, and now I feel I'm growing old with him, which is rather nice because he is very good at having ways of expressing age and the way you deal with life through various stages of it. I think the reason he's my favourite author still is that he's enduring, and that he doesn't stay in one place. He's to do with the drama, he's to do with the poetry. And poems move into the drama. I think it's quite important for me that poetry isn't just on the page. It's in my head, but it's also outside, and I love watching it on the stage. Because if you think about Romeo and Juliet, they are dancing sonnets. Sonnets are beautiful to read, they're beautiful to hear, but you can actually see them in a play being danced. And only Shakespeare does that, I think. There may be another dramatist who does something similar. But it's the drama and the poetry's connections which matter to me. The fact that he used traditions so well in his work, the way he wrote about love, I don't think anybody's written about it quite so well for so long. There's so many plays and so many poems. And we've all learnt from them. I still find it remarkable that he could write a whole play in verse, and you don't realise it's in verse. Richard II is... Sometimes you notice the couplets, but you wouldn't really perhaps notice all the rest. I like to think of poems being dramatic moments, so obviously that would tie in with my love of Shakespeare. And I think He is, although he comes from the south and I come from the north, I learned about him when I was young, and I've always felt that he didn't just belong in the south, that he was literally a national poet.
And he's not only a national poet, but he's also very international. And I'm impressed by the way he can mean so many different things to so many different people in different countries. There's a play for every situation, and very often political situations are as important as personal ones. Countries adapt particular plays take them to their hearts. So Hamlet might mean a great deal in one place, but a more obscure play, perhaps Coriolanus, will mean a great deal in a place where there is some uncertainty. And I think the way you can relate to Shakespeare as a person in a particular political context can also help you to relate to him in a personal way. He will appeal to people, certain plays will appeal to people at different times in their lives. I've always loved Cymbeline, which is not the play most people would think of as popular. But I find it fascinating for the tradition he buries in there, the fact that it was written when Christ was born, and that goes right through the play in the background. Just as in a poem you can have something that isn't spoken as such, but carries a lot of meaning as an undercurrent. And I think he was the master of that. And the traditions that he played on, he used the things he knew people knew and made them remember them and hinted at things and brought all sorts of memories to the fore, cultural memories as well as other things. I think Shakespeare is the poet who will perhaps last the most. Because of the imagery that he manages to convey through the plays and the poems. There's a line in Cymbeline, "Hang there like fruit, my soul, till the tree die." And I always think it's quite a challenge. Posthumus, the character who speaks that, is not perhaps the most admirable character, especially at that point. And yet, those are the most wonderful lines. And you can imagine, just from that description, the woman who's thought he was dead, who's been loving him all the time, is suddenly reunited with him. And suddenly that bond is reunited. And you do feel that Shakespeare has captured, he's describing it. He's not content to just let you watch it. He makes the poetry another layer over the top of the drama. And when you watch it, you have that superimposed on you. And it's an emotional thing. So that's the other reason he's my favourite author, because of the emotion.
That was Robin Bolam. The novelist and non-fiction writer Alex Martin is fascinated with Mediterranean culture and has recently turned to writing crime fiction set in Greece. His own favourite author has been a source of inspiration for invoking that underworld beneath the sunshine.
My favourite author is Jean-Claude Izzo. That's spelled I-Z-Z-O. He's of Italian origin, lived in Marseille from 1945 to 2000. I'm sorry to say he died rather young. He wrote a fabulous trilogy, the Marseille trilogy. Three books are Total Chaos, Churmo and Solea. And he's credited with creating a genre called Mediterranean Noir, which is one that I'm working in myself now. I discovered him while I was living in Athens, writing a crime novel. It seemed to me the only kind of novel one could write in Athens, because there's an enormous amount of crime committed by the state in Greece. There's but one criminal and that's all. Whereas conventional crime, there's not all that much of. But Izzo, the way he writes about Marseille, suddenly gave me a huge lift up. He was an enormous help to me in my own writing about Athens. He writes about Marseille. Obviously, it's a port. It's an ancient port, and it's also a great ethnic melting pot. He writes with enormous sympathy about the Algerians, the Moroccans, particularly the North Africans living in Marseille. And he obviously knew them very well, and not only knew them as people, but the music that they listened to. And again, not just folk music and so on, but the music that the young people listened to. So there's a lot of that. I mean, you can read these books and you can learn a great deal about North African youth culture in the south of France. So they're ethnographically extremely interesting. at the same time as being absolutely rip-roaring crime novels. I mean, they are, you know, the ancient fight between good and evil. They usually start with the death of a very innocent and young person, usually. And the killers turn out to be people in the mafia, people in the rather dirty side of business, organised crime, drugs, that sort of thing. He takes you to some pretty horrible places, but he always does it with immense humanity. And perhaps the most memorable thing about his writing is the character of his detective, who is called Fabio Montale, like Izzo in Italian. He loves food, he loves women, he adores music. Whenever he goes in his car, he puts in a cassette and listens to some favourite piece of jazz or a singer. He loves wine, and he tells you exactly what wine he's drinking and what food he's eating. And it's not done in that rather sort of she-she way, like the Financial Times weekend interviews where, you know, the Prime Minister of Singapore is interviewed over some very expensive dish in a New York restaurant. This is real soul food, and he talks about food brilliantly. He writes about it very, very well. Fabio, the detective, is a policeman who gets into trouble with his colleagues, basically because he's on the side of justice rather than just the law or a quiet life. Fabio is a chaotic character. He drinks too much. He smokes too much. He loves his friends, he'd do anything for his friends, but somehow his relationships with women have always broken down. He's a thoroughly sort of likeable and understandable person. And I must say, as a way of writing about the Mediterranean, I think Izzo's achieved something quite extraordinary. The fact is, the Mediterranean, looked at from this side of the English Channel, seems like a kind of paradise, but actually when you're there, you realise that the immense physical beauty that you see around you, this wonderful climate and so on, has its corresponding darkness. And that darkness really is something ghastly. I mean, there's political corruption, kind of hopelessness about life, which when you visit for a couple of weeks in the summer, you just can't believe that it's like that. But Izzo captures that terrible melancholy that you get in the Mediterranean. And he creates great, I think, great literature out of it.
That was Alex Martin. Lynn Webster Wild is a writer of fiction, non-fiction, and something in between. Having explored myth and folklore in her own work, she appreciates it all the more in the lesser-known books of her favourite author.
I've actually chosen an author as my favourite, and because I can't decide which of his books, but it's John Buchan. And I've loved John Buchan since I was about 12, and I still regularly reread his books, particularly if I have the flu. I think he's a master storyteller. He's a bit fey and uncanny, and he's interested in the strange things that happen in the woods, but in a rather brisk Scottish way. You know, he's a son of the manse. And yet he's also a bit fey, and I suppose I identify with that. And I think, his adventure books, everybody loves. His thrillers are very popular still, but the real masterpieces are books like Witchwood and The Blanket of the Dark, and Witchwood is a very scary tale of witchcraft. And it's got that kind of Scottish respect for the uncanny in it, but it's also got a bit of a kind of moral tone somewhere. But he really understands the folklore, the magic of Scotland, but he's also an upstandish British gentleman, you know, who knows the right people and goes shooting. I love all those contradictions in Buchan's character. And he's so unpretentious. You know, he just used to sit down and knock off his books. He didn't think anything much of them. He didn't think they were the important part of his life. And so they're so uncreative writing schoolish. They're so absorbing and managing to combine great storytelling with lovely, crisp, evocative language. And the characters are very dated, but I find that rather charming. My first encounter, I was 12, And it was the first New Year that I was to be allowed to stay up. And I remember lying on the sofa reading a John Buchan short story. And it was about how a man wandered into the hollow hills and met the fairy folk and never emerged. And I was terrified. But he got me then. That was it. He got me. I'm not a great rereader. I mean, I will reread some of Dickens, Our Mutual Friend, particularly, that I love. But there's something about Buchan that when your spirits are low, he just has such a kind of an unfashionably positive outlook on life. And he doesn't have any doubts that his way of viewing Britain and the importance of Britain in the world is the right one. And somehow there's a kind of sunny innocence about him. In the days before you had to have certain politically correct attitudes. And he's not a racist. Some people say, oh, he's a bit of a racist. He says bad things about the Jews. But I think he's just reflecting the normal prejudices of the time. And you know, his books cover all sections of society. There's the Dixon McCunn books about a grocer and the lads from the Gorbals who solve various mysteries. And then you've got Richard Hannay, of course, who's a posh person, a soldier. And the most lovely book, actually, now that I'm really going through them in my mind, is Sick Heart River, which is one of his late books and is about a dying man. And it's the lawyer Edward Leeson, who's never married and is a rather sad, somber old guy. And he goes to Canada and has one last adventure while he's dying. And it's a very profound book. And all Buchan's books, to me, have got that kind of implicit participation in nature, in wildlife, understanding of human endeavour, but a basic kind of optimism are in them, that we can make the world better. See, I don't really personally believe we can, actually, but when I read Buchan, he convinces me it is possible. I'm reconnecting with my childhood, with my holidays and my culture, where I come from. Where would you start with Buchan? I think you should read either Witchwood or Blanket of the Dark, because they're uncharacteristic and they are actually in the category of good literature as well as being a great tale. The Blanket of the Dark is about a young man who doesn't know that he's actually to become the king, and he has all these adventures in the woodland, and he meets the gypsies and he meets the goddess at one point, or thinks he does. And it's Buchan at his most artless and evocative.
That was Lynn Webster Wild. The science writer and poet Peter Forbes is, perhaps unsurprisingly, interested in the relationship between art and science. So in which sphere would he find his favourite author? Since he edited the UK's premier poetry journal, Poetry Review, for 16 years, perhaps we shouldn't be surprised to discover that Peter's selected writer is indeed a poet.
Like most people, obviously I have quite a few favourite writers, but if I had to choose one, it will be the poet Louis MacNeice. I was very lucky in discovering MacNeice the way I discovered him. I didn't really like poetry very much at school. I discovered the Liverpool poets in my teenage years, but didn't go beyond that. And then in my 20s, I started to get very interested in poetry. And what I read was very influenced by the stock in the local library. This was Golders Green Public Library. They didn't have a lot of poetry, but they had the collected poems of Louis MacNeice, who I'd never heard of. But I was in an exploratory kind of mood, so I took it down and read it. And instantly, it struck me that this was the kind of poetry I always wanted to read. MacNeice is regarded as a sort of second string to Auden generally, but he's very different from Auden, and who I love also, obviously. But there are poets who say general things that appeal perhaps to very many people, but there's a poet just for you, who writes just for you, and that's MacNeice for me. The great thing about MacNeice is that I always call him the man of moments. He's always trying to describe epiphanies, beautiful moments, but he always sets them. He always knows that these moments can't last. He has a classic poem called Sunlight in the Garden. We cannot cage the minute within its nets of gold. But he keeps on trying to do this. He keeps on coming up with these beautiful images, sharp sunstrops, surface gloss and momentary caprice. But what he does is he sets these wonderful moments against the knowledge that they don't endure, that life is not really like that. But you have to have the moments to enliven it. Otherwise, as he said, life would just be a drag from numbered stone to numbered stone. You have to have the moments of glory, even though they pass so quickly. His work is littered with these images. There's one, only let it form within his hands once more, the moment cradle like a brandy glass. That's the kind of phrase that, once I read a phrase, I never forget it. These magic moments are cradle like a brandy glass, the aroma, the beauty encapsulated. But what he does is that he has this wonderful knack of setting these moments against the flux of life. And his great poem, Autumn Journal, a very long poem, it's set in the time of the Munich crisis. And he says how in times of crisis, all our little personal concerns somehow seem magnified. You can see that you're part of the march of history, however terrible. All our trivial daily acts are altered into heroic or romantic make-believe. And in the end, the beautiful thing for me about McNeice is that in life we're always asked to choose between two opposing entities, the dichotomies, art versus science. You can either be an aesthete or a hearty, or you could in the 30s. North versus south. Are you a techie or are you a green? Do you think everything should be organic or do you accept synthetics? So on all these dichotomies, I've always jibbed against this. The great thing about McNeice was that he talked about having the split vision of a juggler. You have to take something from each and you have to know when you have to adjust. If you put yourself all in one camp and shut out the other, you're going to narrow your life terribly. And so he says that although he recognises that the pleasure we take in the pleasures of life, he talks about Plato says that bodily pleasure is like pouring water through a sieve. He says, yes, it is, but he says the rhythm which the intercrossing coloured waters permanently give are what give life its meaning. So you have to accept the drudgery and the fact that the moments don't last, but you have to celebrate the moments as well. That's the glory of McNeice.
That was Peter Forbes. If you'd like to listen to more from the authors featured in this episode, you can hear Robin Bolam's interview with Julia Kopis in episode 20, and Alex Martin speaks with Carol Angier in episodes 60 and 64. Peter Forbes's interview with Carol Angier can be heard in forthcoming episode 92, and Lynn Webster Wild's interview with George Miller in the forthcoming episode 95. You can also find out more about all these writers and hear other recordings in the Writers Aloud and Vox series on the RLF website. And that concludes episode 114, which was recorded by Julia Kopis, Carol Angier and George Miller, and produced by Kona McPhee. Coming up in episode 115, the novelist Livy Michael speaks with Frances Burns about the long-standing appeal of the epic and of the writer's need for courage. We hope you'll join us. You've been listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. To subscribe to podcasts and to find out more about the work of the RLF, please visit our website at www.rlf.org.uk. Thanks for listening.